This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. Over the past year, we've watched millions of people lose their jobs, take pay cuts, even seek new career paths because of the cascading effects of COVID-19. It was and still is a tough time to make a living. When you think about it, there are a number of close parallels between the health and climate crisis, and the job market sits directly in the center of this Venn diagram. When extreme weather and changing environments sweep in with unlimited force, almost no one is immune, and our livelihoods are put at risk. For some, it might be work conditions. For others, their position may no longer be necessary. And for a small group, there is opportunity. Certain business sectors are more vulnerable than others to climate disruption. The fossil fuel industry, for example, could be completely dismantled, and even C-level executives will be out of work. Where will these communities find new employment? Agriculture has already been distressed by inclement weather, and it stands to take more losses if conditions don't improve. That, in turn, influences where people choose to live and how we operate on a daily basis. On the other hand, there's a wide range of new jobs being established to support technology and infrastructure, and there's newfound interest in climate adaptation and in reducing greenhouse gases. The law is changing rapidly in the context of climate change, and that means we're going to need more lawyers with more knowledge and new skills. That's a silver lining, the one that we always talk about and look for when things get difficult and solutions are hard to grasp. So, in the face of the climate crisis, the question then is, who's hiring?
There's a lot of pride in communities like that have provided electricity for millions of Americans for 50 plus years now. But we know we have to transition from an economic perspective, but also from a climate perspective. And we can't leave workers behind as we transition to a cleaner economy.
It's not only the residential properties we need to worry about, but if we have coastal cities where the majority of economic activity is taking place, we're likely to see an effect on production costs, an effect on the mobility of workers. And so that could change where businesses decide to locate in the future.
Farm workers can't be that choosy, and they'll work through horrendous conditions, sometimes by choice because they need money to send back to their families, but sometimes because they will be fired or don't actually have an economic choice to not work.
There are roles for everyone to play. You know, people who work on trail maintenance, people who do school gardens, people who are looking at carbon sequestration, whether it's through technological or natural means.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. On today's episode, we're looking at the American workforce and how climate disruption is both shaking things up and providing new career avenues for those dedicated to the charge. We've been doing this podcast for six seasons now, and no matter what topic we've talked about related to the climate crisis, one issue comes up over and over again. How will this affect the job market? And what's going to happen at work? For years, the biggest focus of this discussion was on how shutting down the fossil fuel industry would upend livelihoods. This would send shockwaves into communities built around those businesses. Now, some of that might be exaggerated. Some jobs in the carbon fuel sector are, in fact, transferable to green energy. Workers serving offshore oil platforms, for instance, could continue to serve offshore wind farms without a lot of new training. But still, a lot of careers are going to be disrupted. But it's more than that now. The impacts of climate disruption extend far beyond fossil fuels. Agriculture's taking a hit overall. Anyone who works outdoors is at a health risk due to extreme heat or cold. Transportation delays cause supply chain issues. Hurricanes and fires destroy offices and warehouses. Even banks are feeling the burn. A recent report by the Financial Stability Oversight Council points out that climate change poses a substantial threat to the banking industry. Higher temperatures create more natural disasters, hurricanes, wildfires, and floods. All those lead to damaged property, lost income, and disruptions in business operations. Furthermore, fluctuations to the stock market because of the move away from fossil fuels put a strain on this sector. The report calls the climate crisis a, quote, emerging threat to the stability of the U.S. financial system. Well, that's bad news. The good news is that banks do seem to be adapting. Those seeking to gain a competitive advantage are creating new services for climate-conscious customers. One study found two-thirds of U.S. banks are prepared to direct capital away from fossil fuels in order to assist in the transition to a low-carbon economy. And since there are now a lot of people out there who want to do something to counter climate change, there's a market for products to boost business. At least a third of all consumers are interested in checking accounts with rewards for eco-friendly purchases, debit cards made from renewable or upcycled materials, an option to plant a tree with every Roundup, or policies that prevent deposits from funding fossil fuel production. That makes me think of our friend Pete Helwig from Season 5. He started the company Atmos Financial, which invests savings accounts into climate-friendly innovations. In addition, there's a growing interest in green lending products like home modernization loans, green mortgages, and green car loans. And since climate-conscious consumers hold roughly $788 billion in deposits, that's about 35% of all bank deposits, there's a lot of money to spend. The average checking account balance of these buyers is nearly $14,000, 50% higher than the national average, and about one in five have taken out at least one loan over the past 3 years. We are seeing that across industries. There are always opportunities to make lemonade, even when the fruits are particularly sour. With changing environments and evolving products, roles in various industries are similarly changing. The need to know more about the science of it all has driven young people to follow academic pursuits related to environmental studies. We met Kimberly Miner previously this season. She's a scientist and a systems engineer at the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab, where she researches and forecasts climate risks. She's also a mentor to young people going into her field. Kimberly says the excitement and interest is palpable.
There are roles for everyone to play, you know, people who work on trail maintenance, people who do school gardens, people who are looking at carbon sequestration, whether it's through technological or natural means. There are lots of roles, there's lots of hats. And so I think that if students especially have this drive, that I just really want to encourage them to seek out the path where they're going to find their strongest calling and have the momentum to keep going when things get challenging. There was a period where it got real quiet and I was working really hard and having a little bit of trouble finding collaborators who were interested in talking about some of the risks. That has really turned, and that momentum that we were all hoping for is there. Young people speaking out and being strong advocates is definitely really, really helpful. I think that there has been growing concern with natural disasters. It's becoming very clear that it's important to take action as soon as possible. There's political and policy moves that have really helped with that. And so I think that's been a huge change that I've noticed in the past 5 years, that people are starting to get really motivated and really integrated into these conversations in a way that I'm not really sure people were 5 years ago. And I think it's an amazing sign of progress.
One potential job worth considering might well be Kimberly's. Her interest in the environment came at a young age on account of her love for the outdoors and led her to study environmental science in school. She's since gone on to research weather in extreme environments around the world, places like Antarctica, the Alps, and the Himalayas, including Mount Everest, where her team secured a Guinness World Record for identifying the highest altitude pollutants. Before NASA, Kimberly worked with the Department of Defense outside Washington, D.C., assessing climate risks to national interests. And on top of all that, she's a certified wilderness firefighter and first responder. These days, Kimberly's research has brought her to Alaska, where she's examining permafrost.
We've got something called the permafrost carbon feedback that we are tracking and trying to forecast, which is basically the more the permafrost thaws, the more potential for methane and CO2 release to the atmosphere. That's the feedback component of it. But the other thing that we were interested in that was a lesser known risk is all of the things that permafrost houses, right? Could be some viruses, definitely diversity of microbes, including extremophilic microbes. But then we've also used the permafrost as a warehouse for some of the ickiest human substances, nuclear waste being one of those. So all of that has the potential to be mobile in the future if we don't slow down permafrost thaw. We went to the permafrost tunnel that is dug and maintained by the Army Corps of Engineers, and you can walk through permafrost that's up to 40,000 years old.
For those who like to explore, travel, make a difference, being a climate scientist comes with some perks. It's an emerging field. Other sectors also offer advantages when shifting to cleaner positions, but may require more convincing. As we mentioned, people working in fossil fuels are concerned that moving towards clean energy puts their jobs at risk. But the truth is, the number of jobs in renewable energy increased worldwide in 2020, despite the pandemic, with clean energy positions holding up better than fossil fuels. In total, there were 12 million jobs in renewable energy and its supply chains last year. A third of those were in solar power. I spoke with Lowell Chandler about this. He's the environmental attorney we met on a previous episode, and he's seeing the battle erupt in his own community.
The biggest problem that I've faced so far from a legal perspective is just the way that partisan politics gets in the way of positive action on climate change, which is an existential threat to human existence, whether it's on a local level, state level, or the national level. It's difficult to bridge the divide that has been created of partisan politics. And unfortunately, climate change and environmental issues have been so divided that we're not taking action to incentivize, for example, renewable energy on the scale that we should. I see a play out here in Montana where we have an amazing, incredible opportunity, particularly with wind, but also solar, to pursue these new technologies. But instead of incentivizing the shift and the transition and helping workers that are currently in the coal industry to transition to the new technologies, our legislature is disincentivizing renewable energy and trying to prop up what is a dying technology, which is coal, as well as gas, you know, in some facets as well. That's creating an issue not only from a climate perspective, but from a labor and lifestyle perspective. Communities need revenue, and there's revenue on the table from these wind developer companies as well as solar, but there's all these regulatory and statutory hurdles that developers are confronted with. And it's unfortunate for the communities, it's unfortunate for the developers, and it's unfortunate for the climate.
Like many areas the fossil fuel industry calls home, a substantial portion of Lowell's community relies on these businesses to survive. It's what a lot of people do for work, and their success trickles out into local businesses. When a plant goes under, the community goes down.
For cities like Missoula, there's definitely a change in the labor market to more of a technology-based market. Less agriculture, less mining, less logging. There is a deeper story. It's not only necessarily an industry's grip on politicians, but industry's grip on communities and community identity. A community that comes to mind for me is Colstrip. It's in southeastern Montana. It grew up around the Colstrip coal plant. There's four coal units, as well as quite a bit of mining activity around the area as well. And units 1 and 2 were recently retired, largely because of economics, as well as an inability to meet clean air standards. Units 3 and 4 have been set to be retired as well in the near future. That area, I think, has a lot of potential from a wind energy perspective, as well as solar. But the town itself has grown up around being a power generator from a centralized power plant. It's probably pretty difficult for a community to go from working at a plant that's located right in town to, you know, constructing and servicing wind turbines that are kind of scattered about. It fundamentally, it's just a different thing.
There's also the matter of tradition and comfort in what's familiar and historically successful.
There's a lot of pride as well in communities like that that have provided electricity for millions of Americans for 50 plus years now. It's warranted. They have every right to be proud of that. But we know we have to transition from an economic perspective, but also from a climate perspective. We can't leave workers behind as we transition our economy to a cleaner economy. That's the messaging that needs to happen, is that yes, these plants need to be closed. However, we're not going to leave any community behind. I hope that there will be a shift from the coal industry and mining industry in Montana to renewable energy. I'm hoping that our legislators see the writing on the wall and invest now and incentivize now before Montana loses its opportunity.
Some jobs directly relate to the environment, like we've mentioned, oil and gas, farming, scientific research. For others, there are indirect consequences of the climate crisis that require a level of consideration and adaptation. In some cases, it's not what we do for work, but how we do our jobs that needs adjusting. Commuting has always been affected by the weather. I even remember missing school when it snowed in Las Vegas, where I grew up. That doesn't happen much anymore. But in the face of a catastrophic storm, getting to your desk in the morning could be really dangerous. Buildings where we work might suffer damages from wildfires or hurricanes. 88% of large companies have already had a physical asset, such as an office or a warehouse, affected by extreme weather. Look at the impact of Hurricane Ida last year. The storm caused an estimated $27 to $40 billion in property damage. Some companies are wasting no time in their charge to adapt. They're improving infrastructure and investing in new technology. In Los Angeles and New York, Lendlease, a property developer and owner, is producing a string of mixed-use sustainable developments to attract better tenants and get ahead of forthcoming regulations. In LA specifically, Lendlease will be opening a $600 million residential and office building by 2025, which will include an all-electric residential tower, solar panels, and a pedestrian plaza. Valerie Mueller studies climate change, migration, economics, and labor adaptation. She's an assistant professor in the School of Politics and Global Studies at Arizona State University. Her big concern is with productivity.
But we were actually looking at socioeconomic data on where people were living and where people were commuting to, and sort of putting that together with tidal flooding data, and saw that commuting delays are already occurring. Granted, by 2060, they're going to be much worse. But in places that already had high frequency of tidal flooding, we saw commuting delays on the order of 200 plus minutes a year. It's not only the residential properties we need to worry about, but if we have coastal cities where the majority of economic activity is taking place, we're likely to see an effect on production costs, an effect on the mobility of workers. And so that could change where businesses decide to locate in the future.
A lot of Valerie's research has looked at how climate disruption interrupts the global agricultural sector. According to her, China has been documenting the effects of extreme heat on firm productivity and the extent those affect labor productivity and capital productivity. There's a lot of overlap, but it's not limited to farmers.
We haven't seen much with respect to how the industrial sector might be affected by heat in the U.S. With the exception of agriculture, we're protected with air conditioning and ways to make our lives a bit more comfortable. But with sea level rise, it's going to reflect on how production costs, how much more costly it makes for firms to produce in areas that have roads that are inundated with salty water. It could be a matter of not only on the sort of demand side of labor, I think things will shift because it may be costlier for businesses to sort of be located in areas where it makes production a bit more challenging, but also on the labor supply side, I think that the preferences to live in locations where you have a lower commuting delays and also lower risk for your car getting damaged from salty water and those types of things, or missing a day of work or not being able to go to the market, will likely affect where people want to live and work.
Not to mention earnings. When a business suffers a profit loss, employees might see pay cuts. They could lose their jobs or some of their benefits. Meanwhile, workloads might actually increase or become more grueling, and prices can go up to account for these deficits. Food is the great connector. Who doesn't love sharing a good meal? So it's interesting to use this vessel as a way of understanding how the climate crisis will impact everyone. We've all experienced how weather shapes our diets in some capacity. Some fruits and vegetables can only be grown under certain conditions. We eat cherries in the summer and apples in the fall. On occasion, our favorite cookie is out of stock because the delivery truck never made it to the town, perhaps because of an intense storm. So we have to go with a generic option. Even our ability to purchase food can be disturbed by the climate crisis. If it's too expensive to eat something of quality, we may have to choose something else. The agricultural sector knows these facts well, as it lies right in the torrent of climate disruption. Last year, an historic drought derailed California's $6 billion almond industry, which produces roughly 80% of the world's almonds. Farmers were forced to abandon their orchards as water became scarce and expensive. In May, the U.S. Department of Agriculture projected that California's almond crop would hit a record 3.2 billion pounds. But by July, that forecast had dropped 2.8 billion. That was because of low water availability and record heat. Trees were drying up, land was no longer arable. And since the industry previously was booming, hundreds of square miles dedicated to almond orchards now lacked reliable water supplies. The drought additionally drained reservoirs, which were vital to keeping operations in motion. To this date, about a third of California's orchards are planted in areas with unreliable water supplies, and many of them are not going to survive. I brought up the issue with Renata Brillinger, co-founder and executive director of the California Climate and Agriculture Network. She's been working on sustainable agriculture policy and food systems for three decades.
It's been a tough 4 or 5 years. Actually, you could go back even a little further. They're saying now we're in a mega drought period. I think we're basically in a permanent state of arid conditions. This dates back to about the year 2015. There have been a couple of wetter years, but essentially that's how long farmers have been struggling with water scarcity. That's always been the case in California. We've engineered a water system that relies on snowpack and spring melts, gradual spring melts, and a very, very expensive and hardwired water delivery system to move water from the wetter parts of the state to the drier parts to grow food for the country. So that hardscape is being challenged and stretched to its limit right now. The wildfires, of course, sometimes they have very, very obvious impacts on farms. You know, they've a lot of farmland has burned. A lot of farmland is buffers, cities. So they've sometimes suffered damage, but also have kept those fires from moving into urban areas. It's been a very, very challenging 4 years. and vineyards and grazing land and row crops are all, you know, typically are sort of in that area between those wilderness interfaces and the urban ones. And so, you know, that's been helpful from the point of view of slowing down those fires before they get to the urban areas, but very, very challenging for the farmers. But then there's all these indirect effects from wildfires as well, like the smoke inhalation and smoke taint in some cases, depending on where, you know, you are in the state or what crop you're growing. The absorption of by the crops of the smoke has caused a lot of crop loss.
Without water, some California farmers are giving up. In extreme cases, entire industries are moving to new terrain, relocating to where there's a better chance for survival. That's what's happening with almonds, a very water-intensive crop that has long seemed at odds with California's relatively dry climate.
The almond industry is a behemoth. It continues to grow, which I think is testament to the fact that there are some deep pockets and deep wells to continue to sustain that growth. Because, you know, there are also lots of almond orchards that are, or blocks of orchards that are being left without water and are dying and are just, you know, being pulled out. I was just down in Fresno, actually, and I saw blocks and blocks of almond trees, either, you know, uprooted or just dying and falling over. However, it's a very high value crop. So there's a bigger profit margin than there is with some other crops. The other important piece here to think about is about farm scale. I think there's a risk not of agriculture leaving the valley, but of agriculture becoming more and more consolidated as, you know, the groundwater table drops and the cost of drilling wells increases and the regulatory burden increases. The small and medium-sized farmer has a harder and harder time competing economically to find where that water is going to come from to drill the deeper well or to expand their acreage so they can leverage more water. And they have fewer options too in terms of pivoting with regard to, you know, what crops are they going to fallow. They just don't have as much land to work with. So, you know, I think diversification is a key strategy, especially for the smaller and medium-sized grower. The monocrops are very fragile. You know, they're very vulnerable to both water changes, but also shifts in pests that we're seeing. Pest populations change, evolve very quickly, much more quickly than our ability to respond to them, and pests and diseases and weeds. So those pressures are also buffered by increased biodiversity. You can weather a lot more variability if you have a variable set of crops to grow. And I think we will see crops shifting over time.
That brings up another issue relating to farming and climate change, its contribution. Industrial agriculture is a notorious source of methane gas emission. To produce mass amounts of a crop, typically something like corn or soy, and receive subsidies, farmers produce only that crop, which is extraordinarily taxing on the soil and which requires heavy use of fertilizers. They also end up with too much of it. Thus, it's fed to the livestock on factory farms. Factory farms pack as many animals as possible into unsanitary conditions where cows and other animals, well, pass gas. And that is in the form of methane. And then manure piles up, emitting additional quantities of methane when stored in lagoons or holding pits. On top of all this, farm equipment emits carbon dioxide as vehicles move across fields. Transporting produce and livestock to market adds even more. But as Renata points out, regenerative agriculture could have a big impact in more ways than one. Widespread trapping of carbon in soil through practices such as cover cropping and crop rotation could globally store up to the equivalent of 8 billion metric tons of carbon dioxide per year. And composting manure helps decrease methane emissions. You don't need to use as many pesticides, if any at all. With regenerative agriculture, there's less of a threat of all crops being lost to one cause. And that helps to avoid a food supply crisis. On that note, Valerie Mueller says we've already gotten a taste of what's to come.
From what I remember of the food crisis in 2008, part of it was sort of the, you know, change in production practices from, you know, crops to biofuel. But another part of it was, you know, major countries that were experiencing drought that typically exported staples. That type of event can massively affect prices of food products to the global market and could affect sort of the disposable income, you know, low income households have, whether they're in the US or whether they're in other countries. And typically when things could get worse is when you have sort of governments trying to protect consumers in some way, you know, either having some sort of price subsidy or some other sort of protectionist trade policy. What that does is it might provide a short-term solution, but can also sort of disincentivize farmers to produce those crops going forward. I think there's a decent understanding that if, you know, a place like Australia, the United States has some sort of devastating drought, that it's going to affect anyone who's importing or relying on those crops for import. It's been shown that, you know, there's quite a bit of devastating effects from, you know, children can get malnourished. A lot of that is because of intra-household dynamics of how food is allocated within the household during economic distress. So typically in places with more traditional social norms, you know, if you don't have a lot of food, the food's going to be sort of saved for those who are considered more productive members of the family. So that's typically not going to be women, and that's not going to be children. The people that are more likely to be affected by these food shortages that arise from a climatic shock are the ones in urban areas, because they're the ones that are purchasing food rather than producing what they consume. So, you know, urban populations tend to be the greater chunk of the populations nationally. And so that's a bit worrisome. And that's when you see governments investing in, you know, social protection, you know, cash transfers, food transfers to buffer urban populations against food shortages.
Who are some of these low-income communities facing food insecurity? It's many of the people laboring away on the farm. They're also facing health risks related to the climate crisis. As Renata points out, they're trapped by circumstance.
Their pay goes down as the work gets harder, with heat and smoke. And as the yield hits happen, there's a whole ripple effect to the local economy, how difficult the work is to harvest the same amount of food. And then, of course, those costs get passed along to consumers. So there are projections about increasing cost of food in the near future. We've seen that happening with individual crops that, you know, have become seasonally more expensive. But I think what's predicted is that over time, many of the foods grown here will become more expensive gradually. Farm workers are also one of the adaptations to the heat in the valley is to shift the harvest hours or the working hours into cooler parts of the day. So typically that means starting earlier and earlier. The wine industry, for example, already starts their workers, you know, at 3 a.m. with big floodlights in the fields. And that's probably, you know, got some advantages for the workers, but it's also a difficult way of life. I mean, farm workers can't be that choosy all the time. And they'll work through horrendous conditions, sometimes by choice because they need, you know, the money to send back to their families, but sometimes because they will be fired or, you know, don't actually have an economic choice to not work. And this is a huge challenge. There are laws requiring employers to provide masks, both for COVID and for wildfires, but those aren't always enforced. I'd say our farm workers are, as always, you know, at the front lines of all of these impacts, not to mention extreme heat events that are becoming more and more common in the valley. This was the hottest year on record in the Central Valley.
The climate crisis seems to be infiltrating all aspects of work, the commute, infrastructure, even product lines. And in many of these cases, without government intervention, no amount of adaptation will be enough to counter the disruption. We need regulation, and we need financial support. In 2021, President Biden committed trillions of dollars to the American Jobs Plan, one component of which was the Civilian Climate Corps. It creates jobs in areas like conservation, climate resilience, and climate justice. And it provides people working in these fields with living wages, benefits, and predictable work schedules. The idea is that those who may lose or have lost jobs will find new opportunities, and there are incentives for investors to put their money in infrastructure, preventative measures, and essential services for vulnerable communities. These investments can bring clean energy infrastructure and job opportunities to communities where it has been lacking. The Biden administration has also cited agriculture as a linchpin of its strategy to combat climate change and proposed allocating $1 billion to pay farmers $20 for each ton of carbon that they trap in the soil. The federal Healthy Soils, Healthy Climate Act would similarly pay farmers for sequestering carbon in the soil, and if passed, it would invest in research and provide technical support to farmers making the transition to climate-friendly practices. This is similar to laws in California focused on agricultural climate solutions. Again, here's Renata Brillinger.
In 2006, California passed what was called the Global Warming Solutions Act. It was groundbreaking at the time. It was one of the world's most ambitious targets for reducing greenhouse gases, either at the state or the national level. It had a huge range of implications through across the economy. So, in other words, it was intended to affect all sectors of our energy use and lives, and put in motion the implementation of dozens of programs and funding streams and so on. The cap and trade program became a funding vehicle, a funding mechanism for many, many voluntary actions to reduce emissions in many sectors, including agriculture. The regulation caps the biggest emitters of greenhouse gases. These are big industrial sources, like refineries and so on. Puts a cap on those. The cap declines over time, which is one way we get the emissions reductions. The corporations, the companies that are subject to that cap are also required to participate in what's called an auction. Essentially, they're required to purchase a certain number of permits to continue emitting CO2. So they're paying the state to pollute, to allow them to go ahead and continue polluting. But they do have to contribute a certain amount to that auction. They do have to purchase a certain number of permits. The thinking there is that gives the businesses the choice about how they're going to reduce their emissions and how they're going to, over time, improve their performance. So a portion of that money has been the main source of funding for a whole suite of agricultural programs and many, many other programs as well. High-speed rail and electrifying vehicles and weatherizing homes, all kinds of stuff. Some of the details about how the regulation is imposed result in continued pollution and co-pollutants, not just greenhouse gases, but a whole bunch of other pollutants from those facilities that impact the poorest and most socially disadvantaged, and often the communities of color around the state where there are a disproportionate number of polluting facilities. So that is a big shortcoming of how the program is structured.
The program has made a difference in the agricultural sector, nevertheless, particularly in the types of incentives offered to farmers for establishing better practices.
A lot of the practices that reduce greenhouse gases or increase the amount of carbon that's stored in the soil are the same practices that help improve the resilience or fertility or the productivity of the farms. Can include things like applying compost or mulch to the soil, which introduces organic matter into it, reducing the amount of tillage, which is a big source of emissions because as the soil is turned up, the carbon that's in it is exposed to oxygen and it turns into CO2. There are things like managing grazing so that there's improved soil health. There are different strategies for controlling the movement of animals, in the grazing land in tighter groups that mimic the way grazing animals used to move across the landscape here in California millennia ago. So there's a whole bunch of things. There are other programs that incentivize water conservation. There's a program that improves how manure is managed so that there's less methane that's coming off of the manure in the lagoons. And then there's a program that protects farmland just to keep it in farmland.
It goes back to the topic of circular economics and the idea that unbridled growth should not be the goal. Instead, we should aim for a society that replenishes itself, that maximizes the use of resources without discarding them or producing byproducts that reduce the lifespan of our planet. It means there's more of everything to go around. To that end, there's another law going into effect in California this year, SB 1383, that requires some businesses to salvage organic waste and donate anything edible to the community. If you don't, you'll be fined.
There is actually no such thing as waste in a well-functioning system. Whatever is generated as a byproduct, we should figure out a way to use it and turn it back into the same system. Farms can be an amazing model for thinking that way, but they often aren't. Any sort of organic material that's produced on farms ideally would be reused, composted most often, and then turn back into fertility as close as possible to that farm, so that we've got a much tighter energy loop and we can displace the use of chemical fertilizers. With regard to the methane challenge, there are different approaches. There's the idea that we don't really need to change any of the practices on a dairy vis-a-vis manure management. We can just cap those big manure lagoons, catch that methane, and then turn it into some kind of biofuel. That doesn't solve any other problem, though. The lagoon is still polluting in other ways through groundwater and through other gases that are precursors to air pollution in the valley. Especially, it's a big problem. It doesn't improve the odor or the conditions for the animals or the workers. What we focus on is a program or a set of approaches that are managing manure in a way that turns it into compost. So instead of flushing the manure out of the stalls with vast amounts of water and putting it into a pond and capturing the methane out of that pond, instead of that, there are grants now that support farmers in scraping that manure not using the water, using various mechanisms to scrape the manure into a compost pile, essentially. And what this does is it creates this very valuable product in the form of the compost that the grower can use on their fields, or they can sell.
I've got to switch gears now, because as a law professor, I am, of course, interested in changes in the legal workforce as well. And as I tell my law students, there are going to be a bonanza of jobs related to climate change. Earlier this season, I introduced Sean Hecht, a law professor at UCLA and a CPR member scholar. When I asked him about climate change law firms, he told me that more than a decade ago, he would see boutique firms in California touting their climate change practices and wonder if it wasn't a bit of a gimmick. Well, today in California and elsewhere, Sean says it's the real deal.
Companies have to navigate a set of regulations, navigate a set of challenges that relate to greenhouse gas emissions. They have to account for those emissions. They're regulated in many cases under the Clean Air Act. Electric utilities are having to change the way that they produce power. There are legal and regulatory issues embedded in every single step of this. And so right now, there are, I'm sure, thousands of lawyers in the United States who practice law already in ways that are informed by the environmental and energy regulation requirements of state and to a certain extent federal climate policy. And that's been a real change in the profession. You know, if you ask the average environmental lawyer in 2002 what they did, it was fighting about who was going to pay for cleaning up toxic sites. And if you ask the average environmental lawyer today what they do, there's a lot more attention being paid to legal and regulatory issues relating specifically to emissions. That's a huge change.
And we're not just talking about environmental law.
If you're the general counsel of a company, or if you are a transportation planning lawyer for a state agency, or you know, just about any number of different jobs in the world where lawyers are dealing with energy or infrastructure or very, very basic business questions, we now have climate change being part of it. It's part of securities law now because the companies have to make disclosures about climate change and its impacts on their operations. I mean, I would say that for better or worse, we're in a world where lawyers of, you know, who work in all different sectors are going to be thinking more and more about climate change and how it affects their law practice. And certainly within environmental law, you know, if you look at the big court cases that have come out over the last few years, there are more and more of them that are about cutting edge regulation of greenhouse gas emissions and what companies need to do to comply with it. But it's much deeper than that, embedded in so many changes in the way that we use energy in our society.
The climate crisis is changing everything. And if there's some silver lining, it's that all this focused thinking has the potential to create more opportunity, move us toward less polluting processes, and open a path toward more efficient ways of operating. All that takes a lot of work, but the work can be plenty rewarding. Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, @CPRblog, all one word, or Instagram, @progressivereform. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to us, leave us a review. It will help us to reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots on today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guests today, Kimberly Miner, Lowell Chandler, Renata Brillinger, Valerie Mueller, and Sean Hecht, as well as our producer, Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer, Maggie Duane. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Virchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.